Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Psychotic illnesses are devastating, and they are not uncommon, affecting as many as 19 million Americans in some form. They have been historically diagnosed by doctors observing patients in clinical settings. But researchers at UT Southwestern Medical Center have discovered that beyond exhibiting particular behaviors, patients may also experience measurable brain changes, causing them to not only suffer from conditions like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, but also from cognitive problems and distractibility. Joining us to talk about this are two experts from UT Southwestern. Dr. Carol Taminga is chair of psychiatry, and Dr. Elena Ivleva is assistant professor of psychiatry and co-leader of the study that we will be discussing today. Welcome both of you to Think.
Thank you very much. We're delighted to be here.
I want to start at the beginning for people who do not have an MD. What is psychosis?
So psychosis is a set of symptoms that characterizes serious mental illness. Serious mental illnesses like schizophrenia, like psychotic bipolar disorder, like schizoaffective disorder. And we're two doctors at UT Southwestern that are in that group of doctors who actually sits and talks to people with these kinds of illnesses and treats them.
I want to be clear as well that, you know, people hear the word psychotic, and I think in popular literature, it's sort of treated as a stand-in for someone who is automatically dangerous to those around them. That's not necessarily the case with patients experiencing psychosis.
No, it's not the case at all. There are a few people who are with psychosis who have some dangerousness, but by and large, people with psychosis are not dangerous.
So in fact, the rates of homicidal behavior when people are dangerous towards others is not higher among psychotic patients than in general population.
Wow.
They have higher rates of suicide, so sometimes they harm themselves, but not the others.
I was very surprised to read that as many as 6% of people in the population experience psychosis, I guess, at some point in their lives. Is that accurate?
Yes, but it's even more than that, because 6% of the population has psychiatric diagnoses that involve psychosis. But also, psychosis is a kind of a mental condition that can occur in even normal people. About 8 to 9% of healthy people have fleeting psychotic experiences, whether they're paranoid experiences, whether they're occasionally hearing a voice. So that's even in addition to the 6% which have psychosis characterizing an illness.
Wow. Okay, so the standard method of diagnosing someone with a psychotic illness is to sit down with them and talk with them.
Yeah.
That's basically it. Yes, as psychiatrists, you know, we listen to patients' stories. We gather information from their families when we can. We observe their behavior. And then we basically take this clinical information and try to fit it into our diagnostic boxes, which is very difficult. I would say about 40% of our psychotic patients do not necessarily, you know, meet strict criteria for schizophrenia or bipolar disorder and fell somewhere in between. And basically what it tells us is that symptom-driven diagnoses are not very accurate and not valid.
So this is exactly where we started the study that we started at UT Southwestern, and we partnered with four other cities around the country because we were interested in having people with psychosis be able to walk into their doctor's office, sit down and talk for a few minutes just to kind of get the lay of the land. And then we wanted to be able to have psychiatrists order up tests that would tell whether they had one diagnosis or another diagnosis. So we did this study that we have recently published where we took 1,000 people with different kinds of psychosis and 1,000 of their family members and about 500 healthy people. We measured everything we could about brain behavior, and then we were expecting some of these brain behaviors to be diagnostic of some of our diagnoses. Mm-hmm. And we didn't find that.
Yeah. So, you know, the hope was that basically we will capture something in brain anatomy or brain function using biomarker measures, and we can talk about it more, such as electroencephalography, brain imaging, which would help us to support our diagnosis of schizophrenia, let's say, just like, you know, mammograms or blood work support medical diagnosis. And we really were not able to find any measures which would clearly disambiguate, let's say, schizophrenia from bipolar disorder.
So people call them biomarkers these days, and biomarkers for the brain are really measures, things that you can measure and quantify about brain behavior. You can do brain imaging. You can measure brain waves. You can measure eye movements. You can measure cognition. And this all tells you something about the brain. So we did about 50 or 60 different of these biomarkers, hoping that they would fall on diagnoses. And then when somebody walked into a doctor's office with psychosis, the doctor could talk to them for 5 minutes, maybe mm-hmm. 10 minutes, and then order up 3 tests, like when you walked in and had chest pain, or you walked in with sniffles or something to your doctor's office. And we found not one of the 60 biomarkers that cleanly fell on a diagnosis. So we were completely, from our goal in the study, we completely failed. But then what we did, can I keep talking?
Please.
Then what we did was, because we had done such a big study and the data were so broad and so varied that we decided we didn't want to just leave it there. So we pooled all of the people with psychosis, assuming that the diagnoses made no difference. So we forgot about the diagnosis. We pooled all the data, and then we reclustered them based on the biomarkers, based on the brain measures.
And what changed when you did that?
Well,
everything.
We found we had good statisticians working with us, and they clustered into three different groups, which we called biotypes, biotype 1, 2, and 3. And all the diagnoses were represented in all of the three new groups. And all of the groups looked different from each other biologically.
Which might suggest that different biological changes could lead to similar symptoms depending on who the patient is.
And not similar symptoms, but these were similar brain measures.
Okay.
Similar biomarkers. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Just like if you have chest pain, you would look at cardiac symptoms, you would look at lung function, you would look at renal function, and you would divide it into those different groups based on what your test showed you.
So could these biomarkers help to identify someone who has not ever experienced psychosis, but might?
Well, this is a very good question, actually. So this was not necessarily part of our particular study, but there is a broad research going on in the field where they try to use these exact biomarkers as predictors of conversion to psychosis, especially in people who come from, you know, families where there are cases of schizophrenia or bipolar disorder already. Let's say, you know, somebody is a child of parent with schizophrenia. So these biomarkers can be used very early and, in fact, can capture mild brain changes which precede symptoms such as hallucinations or delusions by many, many years. And this is one of the kind of future directions which we may be looking at.
And we found it when we looked at the relatives too.
Yes, that's right. So the unique feature of our study was not that we just looked at patients with the disorders, but also at their first-degree relatives, both affected and unaffected. And what was interesting is that first-degree relatives who share 50% genetic risk with the patients who don't have any psychiatric diagnosis also showed some mild brain abnormalities, such as brain gray matter volume changes, as well as mild EEG and cognition abnormalities.
So I would imagine now you want to know why some people develop psychosis with these brain abnormalities and some mm-hmm. people don't.
Exactly.
Yes.
So how do you determine that? What are
it's
you
like
at?
Solving a mystery, really.
Yeah.
It isn't. The question is not solved yet. Mm-hmm. Genetics must be important. So we have DNA from all of these people, the families, and the healthy controls, and the patients also. We have genetic information now, but we haven't been able to study it completely, so that the genetic background would be important, but also sort of the experiential background of the person is important too. We're hoping that this knowledge will lead us into understanding disease mechanisms. So in the brain, none of our disorders, none of the functional psychiatric disorders have lesions in the brain. So you can't just look at the brain and see anything that's wrong. That's negative because we can't see what's wrong. It's positive because all the wiring is there. As soon as we figure out what's wrong, it will be we think it will be straightforward to correct. But we don't know what's wrong yet.
What is the standard treatment today? Is it mostly medication-based when a patient presents with psychosis?
Yes, that's exactly correct. So the main treatment is psychopharmacological agents, basically, and there are multiple classes of them. Schizophrenia is primarily treated with antipsychotic medication, and bipolar disorder is treated with mood stabilizers as well as antipsychotic medications, some of which show mood stabilizing properties. And just like, you know, on symptom level, this diagnosis show tremendous overlap. They also show substantial overlap in terms of treatment response. So in a sense, if you look at, you know, what people take in the population, many schizophrenia patients take what, you know, psychiatrists would think as bipolar medications and vice versa. And overall, the efficacy of the treatment is modest, I would say. So medications are good by and large. Of course, you know, as psychiatrists, we recommend, and there is a big difference between people who do and don't take medications in terms of their daily functioning and their performance, their ability to maintain normal life. However, based on large clinical trials, about 70% of patients show some improvement, and 30% are what's called treatment refractory, meaning they don't improve no matter what medications we try. And among those who do show improvement, I would say only few are symptom-free and truly able to function at pre-morbid level, meaning how they were before the illness hit.
Are psychotic illnesses progressive? Do they sort of inevitably get worse over time?
No, they start when the psychotic illness generally starts during the teen years, during the late teen years or the early adulthood years, and they start with really a florid episode. They start with
what's called a psychotic break.
A psychotic break. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then usually that'll get better, and then people may have two or three more breaks. Actually, psychosis is usually at its worst during middle years, almost during the childbearing years, and to some degree, some people get better with age. I did want to mention that the medications were all discovered accidentally or serendipitously. They weren't discovered purposefully or rationally. So we're hoping that some of our research will really be able to help us discover the many mechanisms. We assume there's many mechanisms, and there should be a rational medication for every mechanism. So that really is what the driving force is behind our studies.
So if you can figure out how individual brains differ from the norm, you might be able to figure out what to give them to make them better.
That's exactly.
What are the targets in the brain? What are the molecular and circuitry level targets which we can basically affect with our medications and hopefully make them better?
That being said, over the last 25 years, we've learned so much about the brain. The field of neuroscience has just burgeoned with all of this information. So we have a lot of good ideas. As soon as we find a little clue, even a big clue, in psychotic illness, we'll be able to go back to the mouse. We'll be able to go back to the neuroscience laboratory, and we'll be able to discover precise medications to use.
We're talking about biomarkers for psychosis with two psychiatrists from UT Southwestern Medical Center, Dr. Elena Ileva and Dr. Carol Tamminga. We'll come back to our conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join it, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter. I'm @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for THINK comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about newly discovered biomarkers for psychosis with two of the psychiatrists on the team who has made this discovery at UT Southwestern Medical Center. Dr. Carol Taminga is chair of psychiatry, and Dr. Elena Ivleva is assistant professor of psychiatry. If you've got a question, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. I'm curious, when you have a large study where you're dealing with hundreds of patients and families, what it's like to work with patients who are actively psychotic and what the challenges are of sort of keeping them compliant through whatever protocols are required by the study.
So I can just start that a minute by saying that we have a whole team at UT Southwestern, and the team is made up of many different people from different disciplines. And the leader of that team is Dr. Ivleva, so she can really is the perfect one to describe this.
Well, thank you, Carol. No, it definitely takes a big team of people to, you know, to pull something like that, because it's definitely a very large study, a very diverse biomarker panel, which requires a lot of expertise in each single, you know, modality of these biomarkers. You know, back to your question, how it is working with psychotic patients and their families, it is actually lovely, I would say. You know, first thing to mention is that patients who went through this research protocol were, you know, by and large, medicated, relatively stable outpatients. So they are people who still can have symptoms and some perhaps cognitive difficulties, but they're, you know, capable of maintaining study procedures. They're capable of remaining, you know, in the scanner for 1 hour or going through EEG measures, etc. I mean, we had situations where we had to transfer patients to the emergency rooms or, you know, pull them out of protocol because it was just too overwhelming or too much, but not frequently. I would say by and large, in fact, they were, you know, very interested and wanting to learn about the, you know, about the illness in general, about research, you know, how they can improve their functioning, what else can be done in terms of kind of, you know, looking at maybe experimental treatments in the future. So overall, it's been very...
And our patients are very altruistic. I mean, they do have the conscious thought that they that something, that a psychotic illness is very difficult, and they want to be able to understand it and contribute to what the answer is. So that it was that was really gratifying.
Yes.
And we work with four different sites around the country. One is in Boston. One is in Hartford, Connecticut. One is in Baltimore, Maryland, and the other one was in Chicago, Illinois. So we there's the same group at each one of those sites, and we work with people in order to get a diversity of people with psychosis.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also reach the show via email to think@kera.org. Let's speak right now with Anthony in North Dallas. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I'm glad to be on the show. I wanted to contribute a little bit of information and certainly would like to extend my sympathy to those that do have verified mental illnesses. My situation is a little different, where I have in the past been a victim of targeting and electronic surveillance, which was misdiagnosed by my family as disturbed or mentally ill. And after joining a group called Freedom from Covert Harassment and Surveillance, FFCHS, I have found a support group and found many other people that are victims of targeting, bullying, electronic harassment and surveillance.
Well, I'm glad, Anthony, that you had a good resolution. I don't know if you all have done any research into electronic surveillance. If not, we might move on.
It wasn't really a direct part of our research that he's talking about.
Okay. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have an email here from Steve who says, my ex-wife and I were devastated by an anti-malarial drug's effect on our daughter. Before we got her help, her condition degraded to flights of fancy, such as, Dad, social media is telling me I need to go to Norway, and she was off to the DFW airport. I guess the question is about the anti-malarial drug mefloquine.
which has been associated, I know, with symptoms of psychosis in previously very healthy, mentally healthy people.
There are some medications that are associated with psychosis as side effects. Usually most doctors, even medical doctors in addition to psychiatrists, can tell the difference and make that diagnosis. Whenever anybody has these kind of symptoms, it doesn't inevitably mean that the diagnosis is schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, psychotic bipolar disorder. So people should certainly seek medical attention if with anything disturbing.
Is there any concern that in searching for biomarkers, there might be false positives and people who are functioning well might somehow be, you know, if the information were to get into hands that it doesn't belong in, that people might be assumed to have a condition that they don't, in fact, suffer from?
One of the things that we did was that we measured 60 different biomarkers. And when we were able to use these biomarkers to really to form these groups of biotypes, we called them, we used a whole battery of biomarkers. So we used 50 or 60 different biomarkers all together, much like if you walked into your doctor's office and you had a cancer, your doctor would take those cancer cells and look at what kind of battery of genes were abnormal in the tumor cells. We look at a battery of things. We don't look at just one single thing to make a diagnosis.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. And, of course, I'm on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Sharon on the line in Dallas. Hello, Sharon.
Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
Yes. Well, there are two questions I have. I was wanted to know if you were familiar with Dr. Daniel Amen's work using the nuclear imaging devices to look at the different areas of the brain. And he seems to correlate that with the neurotransmitter imbalances. And I was wondering if you had done any work with that or was looking at biomarkers in conjunction with the correlation between the imbalance in neurotransmitters.
Thanks for your call.
So I do know Dr. Amen's work, and in fact, we made several different measures using brain imaging. We're very interested in neurotransmitters, and we're very interested in studying neurotransmitters. In this particular study, we used different kinds of brain imaging. We used different kinds of brain waves that all told us something a little bit more general about the brain than specifically about neurotransmitters. I'll tell you why it's hard to study neurotransmitters in the psychotic brain is because we can't get very close to the tissue. If you have something wrong in your liver, you can take a little piece of liver and actually measure the transmitters in the liver. We can't take a little piece of brain and measure the transmitters in brain. So we have to go about it a little bit more indirectly. But we do make inferences about neurotransmitters and ion channels and things that make up the tissue of the brain.
And I think it's also important to emphasize that, you know, the approach we took to our brain imaging was truly a multimodal approach where we looked at, first of all, brain anatomy, so at very high resolution level, actually, so how, you know, brain is made. And we cannot see cells, just like Carol said, but we can see things like, you know, small brain structures and gray matter volume, white matter volume, etc. Then we looked at brain function, such as, you know, what brain regions activate in patients with psychotic disorders versus those who don't have illness when they, let's say, left to themselves for 5 minutes and just kind of, you know, stay in the scanner, you know, without any specific task. And then we use this group of methodologies which are called connectivity analysis, where we ask the question, how different brain regions talk to each other? So, you know, and what happens if, let's say, there is a hyperactivity in frontal regions of the brain, how that translates to temporal regions of the brain, occipital regions of the brain. So that is very interesting and fascinating. And I think, you know, pulling all these methodologies together, so looking at potential disease mechanisms through multiple channels, so to speak, multiple rounds, can bring some interesting insights.
To the extent that psychotic illnesses tend to wax and wane over the course of a lifetime, can biomarkers be used to predict flare-ups? Can they tell you when someone's close?
We're certainly hoping that that's true. I think since we're just this was a bit of a groundbreaking study, and we don't know how many different directions it can be used in. We do know that people are studying psychotic illness. It's called a prodrome, the psychotic illness before it manifests itself in young people, in teenagers particularly. And they're looking at some of the same measures as we are to look at when that prodrome converts to a psychotic diagnosis. So we would have we would certainly believe that we could translate this to what you're talking about.
What does a prodrome look like in a patient who is not, I guess, able to be clinically diagnosed psychotic yet, but is starting to have problems?
So typically it presents with, kind of first mild psychotic symptoms, such as mild paranoia, suspiciousness, feeling that, classmates or people around this particular individual are plotting against them or thinking some harmful things. Some mild perceptual experiences, such as, simple hallucinations, for example, hearing someone's name being called from behind where nobody's present. Another thing is what's called autization, meaning social withdrawal, kind of, withdrawing from normal interactions with people. And what family typically reports about this young patients, because typically prodrome happens somewhere around teenage years, is this subjective kind of sense of change in the person, that they cannot quite pinpoint what is it exactly that changed, but the person is not the same. And typically those symptoms which I described could be first symptoms of prodrome.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Matt in Dallas. Hi, Matt.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks to your panel for being there.
Sure. Welcome.
I'm sorry. I had a question regarding, I understand that the biomarkers and biotypes are useful for predictive characterism, predicting who may develop issues. I was curious, and particularly for somebody who had experienced problems already but had not yet gotten a clean diagnosis and therefore treatment, I wondered how useful they were from a diagnostic standpoint. Appreciate you taking my call. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Well, this study is still very early, and it's not. This isn't research that's yet at the point of making a diagnosis, but it definitely is research that's pointing us to new ways to make diagnoses, so that to make diagnoses that are based on brain biology rather than based on merely the kind of symptoms that you have that you present to your doctor.
One of the biotypes that you identified was biotype 2, and it's associated with high brainwave response in EEG tests and what psychiatrists call noisy brain or neurologists. What does that mean exactly? What's a noisy brain?
Well, we measure brain waves from the outside of the brain. If we could take an electrode and put it inside of a human brain, that would be better, but we don't do that. But we put a cap, like a bathing cap, on the skull and measure the brain waves that that you can measure from the surface of the brain. These brain waves have been shown to reflect the level of neuronal activity inside of the brain. Biotype 1, which you didn't refer to, has low brain activity and low brain waves, low EEG power, as we would call it. Biomarker number 2 has high activity, and that means that no doubt what we would see it to mean is that the neurons are more active and that they're firing more. They're not necessarily firing more together so that their productive activity isn't greater, but it's just that they're probably firing more and one might call them confused or something like that, not working all together.
It sounds a little bit like the Goldilocks problem, right? You don't want brain activity that is too low and you don't want brain activity that is too high. To be healthy, you have to be somewhere in the middle.
And then your brain regions need to work well together, too.
Right. they need to synchronize and coordinate. You know, I also wanted to add, I mean, this is something we want to look at further. You know, what is the what are the associations between these biomarkers and clinical symptoms? How these biomarkers exactly translate into clinical presentations like, you know, hallucinations or delusions? And this is what we, you know, one of our interests. But I want to say that just clinically speaking, when you talk to people who are at the beginning of their psychotic or manic episode, they frequently report this kind of, you know, subjective brain hypersensitivity or brain hypersensitivity, that's how I call it, where basically they start experiencing, you know, all colors are brighter than they are and noises are louder than they are. And that is pretty frequent to see in people who are just going to the psychotic episode. So it will be interesting down the road to, you know, look at associations between this clinical and subjective phenomena and the brain waves, for example.
Is there anything at all that we can learn about the brain in a state of hallucination or psychosis from what the brain is doing while we're dreaming? And if the answer is no, that's fine. I'm just curious.
There would be a theoretical approach, a kind of a point of view that where one might say yes, but it would be a very distant theory. Mm-hmm. What happens when you're sleeping, and this would get embodied in your dreams, is that the brain is reviewing the memories that it's made during the day. And you can, in animals, you can kind of watch the movement of those memories out of the primary organ in the brain where the memory is made to other parts of the brain where the memory is stored. And then in order to store that memory strongly, the brain replays the memory again and again, as if just like you'd review something if you were trying to learn it. We think that psychosis itself is like a learning and memory disorder, but that this is really a more speculative model.
You said earlier, Carol, that the drugs that have been discovered that seem to work for some patients, at least somewhat, were discovered accidentally. Does this mean, do we know why they work now that we've discovered that some of them are helpful to some patients?
Yes, of course. That was discovered back in the 1950s. Back in the 1950s, the first drug that was of this kind that was tried in schizophrenics was chlorpromazine. And chlorpromazine was used as a pre-anesthetic agent in normal people and takes normal people and just knocks them out. So that some French doctors thought, well, if it knocks out normal people, let's see if we can get a little relief to people who are psychotic. And they gave this drug, chlorpromazine, to psychotic people. And the psychotic people, they were observant enough to notice there was a selective antipsychotic response. And shortly after that, a scientist made the discovery, Arvid Carlson, who's a Nobel Prize winning scientist, made the discovery.
You know, I'm just going to jump in. We have to take a quick break. Hang on 1 second. We're speaking this hour about biomarkers for psychosis. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with two psychiatrists and researchers at UT Southwestern Medical Center. Dr. Elena Ivleva is assistant professor of psychiatry, and Dr. Carol Taminga is chair of psychiatry. We're talking about new biomarkers that they have discovered for different forms of psychosis. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. We were speaking earlier about learning sort of how different drugs would work. Carol, you were telling me during the break that there have been some interesting breakthroughs with regard to early treatments, treating people before they have a full-blown break or simply treating them early in the course of their illness.
Well, people have been trying to discover how you could treat people before the illness had an onset and prevent the illness onset. That's been less important lately than taking the psychosis right at its first break and treating it very aggressively from the beginning. In the past, probably 10 or 15 years ago, we really focused on midlife psychosis because that was the psychosis that we saw most, because that was when they came in to see doctors. Now people have discovered that if you take people who have just had their first break of psychosis, you treat them with an optimal course of medicine. But in addition to the medicine, you treat them with cognitive remediation, you treat them with psychotherapy, you do job counseling, you educate their families, you do psychosocial interventions. It's really a whole very complex, intensive treatment. And if you treat them intensively for perhaps a six-month time course, people have really compared treatment as usual with this more intensive treatment. And at the end of 2 years, the people who have had the intensive treatment have better jobs, they have better cognition, they have lower symptoms, and they're better off altogether. And what we kind of hope now, we've seen the data at 2 years, what we hope is that when these people get to be 30 years old and 40 years old, they'll be much better and they won't need the chronic kinds of treatment that we use today.
So is there evidence that each successive break sort of further entrenches the damage in the brain, the changes in the brain?
Probably not.
This is a little bit complicated. You know, there is no such direct correlation that, you know, 10 episodes is worse than 3 or 5. Mm-hmm. However, you know, if we look at brain structure, we definitely see some association between kind of overall psychosis burden over the course of illness and, you know, what happens to the brain. And what we see is basically a very subtle but measurable decreases in gray matter volume, which is the, you know, part of the brain responsible for thinking processes, cognitive processes, processing of perceptual information, etc. Somewhat resembling what we see in dementias, but to much, you know, milder and softer extent.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Mary Kay on the line in Arlington. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
My question is there any evidence for the onset of psychosis caused by drug use?
I should say that there's perhaps not directly. Some illicit, I'm assuming that you're talking about illicit drugs. There are some illicit drugs that have psychotic symptoms right associated with them, so that somebody takes ketamine. I don't know all the names of ketamine on the street. They take some drugs on the street that cause psychosis. So that, but then when the drug wears away, when the street drug wears away, the psychosis goes away too. There is some evidence that very early cannabis use, marijuana use in children who are between, say, less than 15, regular cannabis use less than 15, is associated with a higher, is one of the risk factors for the onset of psychosis at 18, 19, or 20. And there's some evidence that there's a particular vulnerable genetic structure, so that there's a vulnerable genetic structure on top of which, if you put cannabis, you're more likely to get psychosis.
So that evidence, I guess, is strong enough to preclude the possibility that young people who are using marijuana at an early age are somehow self-medicating against what might later develop into psychosis.
What do you think?
Well, I would say that, you know, it's difficult to translate it directly into, you know, kind of
cause effect.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but I would say that clinically, when we see somebody who is young and who is coming from family where there are already known cases of mental illness, such as cases of schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, we always strongly advise to stay away from any sort of illicit substances, and marijuana in particular, and especially early use. That's been shown to be a big risk factor.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Ruben is on the line now in Dallas. Hi, Ruben.
Hey, Chris. This is Ruben, and I'm actually a child psychiatrist, and I used to be a researcher at UT Southwestern and kids bipolar clinic. I'm a little skeptical of neuroimaging studies. I started listening to the program in the middle of the program, so pardon me if I miss some areas. But in general, my critique is there have been a lack of reproducibility in your imaging studies, and also there's a long lag between, from what I can see, clinically relevant for me as a practitioner rather than in a lab, because there's been a significant critique, especially reproducibility of the studies, multiple statistical analysis of the data to find clinical significance, or p-hacking, as that's called, and then lack of publishing of a negative study. So that's what my critique would be. I'll listen to the response of the phone.
All right. Thanks very much for your call.
So it's actually important to say first that we probably agree with everything that you just said, in that it's really good to be skeptical of data anytime. And what we said earlier that you might have missed is that what we did in this particular study is that we measured perhaps 50 different things. We didn't just measure one thing, so that we put all of these 50 different biomarkers together in order to do this particular study. I think we would totally agree with you that you can't take any one of those, particularly the imaging studies, and make a diagnosis based on any one of those. But Dr. Ivlova actually does imaging research.
Yeah, and I want to say that, you know, concerns about methodological reproducibility, that's very valid, I would say, in imaging studies, especially in studies which are done on small samples and using non-standardized techniques. Well, here we were lucky enough to have 1,800 brains, or scans, I better say, pulled together, and we followed extremely rigorous, you know, procedures for multi-site compatibility, data cleaning, quality control of this imaging data, and on top of everything, again, used multi-modal analysis. So it's not just, let's say, functional MRI or structural MRI. It's the beauty of putting all these modalities together and asking the question from different perspectives. And I can say that methodologically...
And the beauty of the high number.
Yes, and the beauty of high number, which is, right, so here we cannot really blame those p-values on the small sample size, so to speak, echoing your question. So I can say that, you know, this is a very rigorously and very well done, methodologically done imaging protocol, and the data look, I would say, pretty convincing. I mean, they were telling, at least, in... and they were consistent. They formed consistent patterns with other biomarkers.
We have an email here from Kat who says, my mom is a paranoid schizophrenic. Her mother was a paranoid schizophrenic. As a woman of that lineage, it would be an understatement to say I'm terrified. Do you have any recommendations for prevention?
So some of the modalities that have been used to treat first break psychosis are good preventative modalities. I mean, to do cognitive work, to do cognitive remediation, to take care of to try to do the most mentally healthy things with your brain and with your time would be terrific. And to try to maintain a rich social network. What would you say?
I agree. And I think also, staying away from basically brain assaults, such as illicit drugs, excessive drinking, traumatic brain injuries. So those things, if they can be prevented, can be also helpful. I also say that the risk for somebody who has a first degree relative with schizophrenia is about 8-12%. So it is not low, but
it's not overwhelming.
Yes, it's not overwhelming, and it doesn't necessarily mean that, if somebody has a lineage of relatives with schizophrenia, will necessarily develop schizophrenia.
I would imagine that's comforting. That number sounds lower than what I would have assumed it would be, because I suppose you assume that if a brother or a parent had schizophrenia, that you would be at great risk. What do we know about the extent to which schizophrenia is genetic and the extent to which it may be caused by other factors?
So if you have an identical twin with psychosis, your risk for getting psychosis is about between 40-45%.
So that's an identical twin.
Identical mm-hmm. twin. And if you have a non-identical twin, your risk is just like a sibling, about 12%, which isn't – all of that is not very high. But it's high enough to say that genetics is a risk factor, even a strong risk factor, but it's not overwhelming.
And it's again, do we still have a minute? So it's again very complicated, I would say. So what we know about genetic factors for schizophrenia is it's that it's not a single gene disease by any means. So, you know, if you have gene A, you develop it. It's more a combination of multiple genetic abnormalities, each of which is a very small effect. So per our most recent publications from large genetic consortia, there seems to be at least 108 such mild genetic abnormalities which could contribute to development of schizophrenia, but we just don't know how yet.
So most of us don't seek psychiatric care or therapy unless we've had a problem to cope with. Does it make sense for people to do something like a mental health checkup, especially if there's a strong family history?
I was thinking about that with the lady who just called in. I was thinking that it might even make her a stronger person, give her more confidence if she came and talked to a psychiatrist or a psychologist, and develop some strategies to watch herself, to see when and if she was venturing into an area that where she became uncomfortable and what to do in that sort of setting.
One of the reasons that I love talking to scientists is that for every new discovery, you've also discovered like 100 new questions that you want to pursue. What did this research, this achievement in finding what appear to be these biomarkers for psychosis, what did they lead you to? What is next?
I would love to say one answer to that. So from every person who is in this first study, and now we're doing a continuation study, we take a little piece of skin, and these days we can grow this skin into what we call fibroblasts, so that every person then has their own every patient, every family member, every normal control has their own cells growing in this in a petri dish, and you can take those fibroblasts and convert them to neurons. So whereas we don't have any access to neurons in a specific person's brain, we can take their own fibroblasts and we can change them into their own neurons. And then we can take a look at those two different groups, one of the groups with noisy brains, and we can see if their cells are noisy. And if we can see that their cells are noisy, then we can ask the question why. We can look at transmitters. We can look at plasticity in synapses. We can look at potassium channels. So our next at least one of our next goals will be, they're sometimes called disease in a dish, where these the iPS mm-hmm. cells.
Yeah, and exactly. And then, another immediate goal is to look at genetic markers for these biotypes and biomarkers. So we collected DNA from all of our participants. So we have a large DNA bank. And now in the next wave of the study, we will be looking at how these biomarkers are associated with genetic abnormalities. Another goal we would like to pursue is perhaps to try to implement these biomarkers into treatments and to look first at differential responses between people who belong to different biotypes and different subgroups to our known medications, as well as try maybe a little bit out of the box kind of approach to look at a kind of add-on medications which could potentially target the mechanisms which seems to be painting out of our biotypes and biomarkers.
Well, we will look forward to additional information as it becomes available. Thank you so much, Dr. Elena Ivleva, who is Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at UT Southwestern Medical Center, and Dr. Carol Taminga, Chair of Psychiatry at UT Southwestern Medical Center. Pleasure to have you both on the show. Thank you.
You,
thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered today by Justin Martin. Lindsay Connect is associate producer and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.